Will the 79th UN General Assembly use their planned Pact for the Future to undermine democracy and national autonomy? How would the need to stop a planetary emergency be linked to eugenics? Why are the people of Japan speaking out against the newly approved next generation of big pharma vaccines soon to be released worldwide? Could the arrival of Mpox in Africa mark the sequel pandemic to COVID-19? This week on the Global Research News Hour, we are turning our attention to the more subtle yet profound developments in the world, leading us further down the road to a world governed by unelected international figures. In our first half hour, we are greeted by journalist and activist Derek Broz, who will share more information about the Summit of the Future, featured at the UN General Assembly next week, and what it could do to further global governance. Then in our second half hour, we are joined by James Corbett of the Corbett Report, outlining further biosecurity initiatives, including new pandemics, new vaccines, and new pandemic treaties that should put in place the final pieces of the jigsaw puzzle of technocratic dominion of the globe. On this week's program, closing in on world government, Summit of the Future, and the WHO. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of September 20th, 2024. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are featured on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. We acknowledge that this program was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, Innu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. For decades, settlers have benefited from the land, water, and resources that came to them through false promises, broken treaties, and force at the expense of the indigenous people who were here first. And moving forward, we hope to reverse these trends so that the reparations can be at least partially return settler and indigenous populations to a more balanced and respectful partnership. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station. Murray, a former British ambassador, was arrested at the airport under the, quote, Terrorism Act, unquote, for attending a pro-Palestine demonstration in Iceland. Under the Terrorism Act, if you are arrested at an airport, you have no right to remain silent, no right to a lawyer. You must turn over all your electronic devices with the passwords. If you refuse to turn over your electronic devices, it is 2 years in prison. 2 years in prison for refusing to answer a question. Many people are being detained under anti-terrorist legislation, including a professor from Paris and several independent journalists who all have been detained, as was Murray. That comes from the article, quote, "The UK has criminalized dissent," unquote. The transition of Britain and the West into tyranny, former British Ambassador Craig Murray, by Craig Murray and Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, posted September 19th, originally published on the Institute for Political Economy. According to the Welt article, after an event in the city of Prenzlau, in the state of Brandenburg, Scholz said he would remain firm in not authorizing Ukraine to use long-range weapons supplied by Germany to attack targets on Russian territory. "That remains the case. That's why I maintain my position even if other countries decide otherwise. I won't do it because I created it as a problem," Scholz said, as quoted by the newspaper. In July, Russian President Vladimir Putin warned NATO that Ukrainian attacks with weapons supplied by the alliance against Russian territory meant that the member countries were at war with Russia, stressing that it would change the essence of the conflict since 32 countries of the U.S.-led bloc militarily support Ukraine. That comes from the article, Scholz disavows Kiev over using German weapons to attack Russian territory, by Ahmed Adel, posted September 18th, originally published on InfoBricks. Those who know some basics about Russia-China relations understand U.S. sanctions are not doing anything to Russia anymore, as Russia is fully de-dollarized by now. As to punishing Chinese banks for receiving payment from Russia in yuan, that will not work either. Chinese banks are largely immune against U.S. attempted quote-unquote sanctions simply because the U.S. needs them for trading with China. If anybody knows about America's hysteric consumerism, they know not what we are talking about. American average consumers would take to the streets if Chinese goods like iPhones, other electronic equipment, and consumer goods would suddenly, quote, dry up, unquote. That comes from the article, Washington Sanctioning Russia and China, Enhanced Monetary Independence, by Peter Koenig, posted September 18th. The Palestinians are characterized as being largely responsible for their own displacement, isolation, injuries, and deaths. The approach by the Western capitalist news sources labels the resistance forces operating inside Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and Yemen as being only the proxies of the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is accused of being an aspiring nuclear weapons power with the intent to eliminate the State of Israel and its backers in the West Asia and North Africa regions. These claims are utilized to provide a rationale for the ongoing imperialist and Zionist bombing operations and targeted assassinations carried out in Syria, Yemen, Iraq, and Iran. Consequently, there are yearnings among growing numbers of people for different sources of news and political analyses in the global South. In addition, even within the industrial capitalist states of Western Europe, the UK, and North America, more people are turning towards progressive news outlets which encompass a critical outlook towards the corporate and government-controlled media. That comes from the article, Media Conference in Russia Leading Up to BRICS Plus October Summit. Beijing Forum on China-Africa Cooperation, or FOCAC, and the Battle for the Global South, by Abiyomi Ezekiwe, posted September 18th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. While we concern ourselves with the election race between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, inflation, and we address the thoughts about wars in the Middle East and Ukraine, little to no attention is paid to an event at the United Nations called the Summit of the Future, taking place during the 79th session of the UN General Assembly, the annual UN General Assembly. It is argued that the Pact for the Future, to be signed on the 22nd and 23rd of September, could represent the boosting of power of the UN to override the autonomy of individual nations, radically accelerate the push towards the completion of the UN Sustainable Development Goals and the Agenda 2030. There are concerns that this signing may be one more step toward defining a technocratic future for all of us. One of the people who are voicing concern is Derek Brose. He'll be attending the event as a journalist and reporting on its proceeding. And Derek Brose is, he's been on before. He's a staff writer for The Last American Vagabond. He's a journalist, a author, documentary filmmaker, public speaker, and activist. He's the founder of the Conscious Resistance Network,
an independent media outlet dedicated to investigative journalism and the intersection of liberty and spirituality. And he's the writer, director, and narrator of the 17-part documentary series, The Pyramid of Power. He joins us now to talk about the summit gathering. Derek, welcome back to the Global Research News Hour.
Thanks for having me back, Michael. I appreciate it.
So, what, in a nutshell, is so troubling about this benign-sounding pact for the future?
So, yeah, in your intro there, you kind of outlined what has come before. I'll share a little more detail. So in 2020, it was the 75th anniversary of the United Nations. Obviously, COVID was going on. It was a big year for the globalist, internationalist movement, you could say. And that was also around the time, of course, we heard the term the Great Reset. At that same time, the UN was putting out a report calling for accelerating the race to the completion of the Agenda 2030, the race to the completion of the Sustainable Development Goals. You had Secretary General Antonio Guterres putting out statements, sort of lamenting the fact that, in the UN's words, that we were falling behind and that we weren't going to reach the targets for completing this environmental agenda, this transformation of the world, really, by 2030. And so at that time, there was a call for a report to be issued. And this report ended up becoming Our Common Agenda. And it was at the Our Common Agenda report when that was released, which called for two different meetings. One of them was a Sustainable Development Goals Summit, which took place in 2023. And the other was this Summit of the Future. And so for the last 4 years, the United Nations, as well as the World Economic Forum, and then another lesser-known group, to at least the public, the Club of Rome, have been working towards this effort. And you can look at the United Nations websites and reference material, and you can see that they have been really pumping up that everything is going towards the summit of the future. Now, this doesn't mean, of course, this will be the last meeting the UN ever holds, or that at the end of the summit, world government is going to magically appear or anything like that. But it is absolutely a major step forward in that goal, just like we saw during the COVID-19 years. And I've been trying to raise the alarm bells about this for the last year, myself and a few other researchers who've been paying attention, because I'm sure your audience is aware there was a lot of resistance and pushback to the World Health Organization pandemic agreement, to the pandemic treaty. And that has sort of stalled. It's still in the background, but for a moment, a lot of people were paying attention to that, both online and in the real world. People went to go rally in Geneva back in May, but there has been little to no attention paid to the Summit of the Future, which I think is an equal threat, if not a greater threat, than the WHO pandemic agreement was. And I can outline the reasons for that. But the first reason is because of this Pact for the Future document that you mentioned. And there's actually going to be three documents which will be signed by every single 193 member states of the United Nations at the Summit of the Future. That includes the Pact for the Future, what they're calling a Global Digital Compact, and the Declaration on Future Generations. And so these three documents, in their own ways, really set the stage for the UN to grab more powers as we move forward. And there's a few different key points that we can get deeper into. And just briefly, they are that there's calls for a quote, UN 2.0, that it's time to remake or reset the UN. There's talks of potentially invoking the UN Charter to remake the United Nations Security Council. So that's one big thing, this idea that the UN is no longer, it's in their terms, it's no longer fit for purpose because it was created after World War II. And well, at this point, we're dealing with pandemics and wars and economic calamity. And so obviously, individual governments, nation states cannot handle these problems on their own. Thus, it's time to remake the UN to make it stronger. So that's one of the big push that we're seeing. The other thing is this call for resetting the financial systems. We keep seeing references to a new Bretton Woods moment. And of course, Bretton Woods is the agreement that brought us the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, which have been responsible for really extorting and taking resources from developing nations and putting them in debt and stealing their resources and things like that. So they're calling for a new financial system. which will help accelerate the push to the SDGs. And then again, part of the Pact for the Future is also this potential for the declaration of a planetary emergency. And this includes, based on the draft versions that we've seen of the Pact, we've seen three of them so far. There more than likely will be one more released before the summit is happening next weekend, September 22nd and 23rd. But so far, the versions we have seen, both the zero draft and the first, second, and third version, all include language about an emergency platform. And this emergency platform is another, I think, piece of the puzzle that is a bit worrisome, because it essentially says, in the UN's own words, that if there is an emergency which, quote, shocks multiple regions of the world, then the UN could invoke this emergency platform. And what comes next, none of us know for certain, but I do find it interesting that the UN is feeling the need to at least put in language that says, we promise the emergency platform won't be a standing body. It won't be a standing institution. We promise it'll respect national sovereignty. And I think that is because there's this awareness, again, after the WHO pandemic agreement, that so many people are awake to the UN's real intentions about global control. And this definitely ties into the whole eugenics population reduction conversation as well. So I think because of this resistance, that they feel the need to kind of, okay, let's throw a little caveat there about national sovereignty, and let's make sure they know this isn't going to be a standing body. And I guess whether or not you believe that depends on whether or not you trust the UN.
Mm. Yeah, well, when you talk about, the whole idea of being able to declare a planetary emergency and having an emergency platform, it seems to kind of intersect with the pandemic treaty when they were talking about it, because essentially it would give them, they had room to declare a pandemic, like at the snap of a finger, essentially. And I'm wondering if this is also a way of, you know, interacting at a larger level. I mean, it's giving the UN, essentially, because it gives them an opportunity to be a new governing system, effectively a new world order. I gotta ask how when there actually are environmental threats plaguing a region of the planet, whether it's climate change or some other environmental disaster or whatever. I guess I'm just wondering, how would you see it? Like, what's maybe a test example of this emergency situation affecting a certain region of the world?
So the only examples they really provide, of course, they mention climate change. They do mention war. They mention, as I said, economic crises. There also is a whole section in the latest version of the Pact for the Future that deals with space, which I think is interesting because, you know, there's been concerns and about the recent discussions in the mainstream media about UFOs and, you know, threats from beyond. And many folks, I think, in the truth, research, freedom community have been concerned for years about the potential for some type of false flag involving claims of, you know, we're being invaded from the stars or something. I don't know if that's on the table, but there's definitely a lot of attention paid to space and how we need to protect space, and we need to make sure that space is diverse and equitable and sustainable and all this sort of thing. And so the UN is mainly focused on the climate change narrative, but they absolutely do mention potential for new pandemics, potential for other events. And I think they're purposely keeping the language vague because, again, it talks about global shocks to multiple regions of the world. And I want to make the point that there's a few organizations that are really kind of been behind this. One of them is the Stimson Center, which I did some reporting on at the last American Vagabond. The Stimson Center, that's spelled S-T-I-M-S-O-N. They have been around for quite some time, but I don't think they've gotten the attention that the Rockefeller Foundation or the Gates Foundation and others have. But they're definitely tied to that whole nexus. And they have been one of the biggest proponents of this idea of not only the Summit for the Future, but they've been one of the biggest groups calling on the UN to declare a planetary emergency. And the planetary emergency, again, you can find another organization also funded by the Rockefellers called the Climate Governance Commission that has been promoting this idea about the need to declare this planetary emergency. They put out a November 2023 report that actually came out at the UN Climate Change Conference, COP28, and it was called Governing Our Planetary Emergency. And at that, with that report, which came out last year, they said, quote, We therefore urge the UN General Assembly at the 2024 Summit of the Future to declare a planetary emergency, recognizing that the triple planetary crisis poses a grave risk to global stability and security, and to be reinforced in similar statements by bodies and agencies of the UN system. And so, they talk about this triple planetary crisis, which is deforestation, biodiversity loss, and climate change. And that sort of echoes statements and terms we've heard from the World Economic Forum, who've been pushing this idea of polycrisis for a couple of years now. We're dealing with a polycrisis. And all of this is designed to get the public to believe that the Earth is in such a state of calamity that the only way we can make it through this is to come together as a world government. There's no way that France or Mexico or the United States or the UK or Canada can handle this on our own, because it's global in scope, and thus we need to come together and use this Pact for the Future to either declare a planetary emergency. And I will say I have less confidence that they're actually going to do that at this event, in terms of literally saying we now declare a planetary emergency. But 100%, the current version of the Pact for the Future does include this emergency platform I mentioned. So even if they don't outright declare the emergency yet, they're putting in place the infrastructure so that if they later declare this planetary emergency, they can go ahead and kind of rapidly accelerate their plans and their goals. And, you know, one other point I'll just mention here is that we can look back to the Club of Rome, and I encourage folks who are not familiar with the Club of Rome to become more familiar with them. They have deep ties, of course, to Henry Kissinger and to the World Economic Forum's beginnings as well. But the Club of Rome, they've actually been talking about this since before the Climate Governance Commission or the Stimson Center or the UN even. You can find, I found a report in 2019, which was called Planetary Emergency Plan. And it was just all about this whole idea. And then a year later, the Club of Rome updated the report in August 2020, of course, a few months after we were into the COVID-1984 nightmare. And the Club of Rome described this report as, quote, a roadmap for governments and other stakeholders to shift our societies and economies to bring back balance between people, planet, and prosperity. And so this all goes back to the Club of Rome. And for those who are unaware of their history, it absolutely is a eugenicist history. You can look at their 1991 report titled The First Global Revolution, which was written by a man named Alexander King, who is one of the co-founders of the Club of Rome, who attended the 1973 meeting of the first meeting of the World Economic Forum. And it is in this report titled The First Global Revolution, which includes a section titled The Common Enemy of Humanity is Man. And it is this section which many of us point to and say, hey, look, the Club of Rome clearly are eugenicists. They believe in population reduction. They claim that this has been misinterpreted, but I'll just quote it for your audience really briefly, and then they can decide what they think on their own. So again, this is from a 1991 report titled The First Global Revolution. The section is titled The Common Enemy of Humanity is Man. And it says, quote, in searching for a new enemy to unite us, we came up with the idea that that pollution, the threat of global warming, water shortages, famine, and the like would fit the bill. In their totality and in their interactions, these phenomena do constitute a common threat which demands the solidarity of all peoples. But in designating them as the enemy, we fall into the trap about which we have already warned, namely mistaking symptoms for causes. All these dangers are caused by human intervention, and it is only through changed attitudes and behavior that they can be overcome. The real enemy, then, is humanity itself. Yeah. So this is really the root of the Summit of the Future, this call for a planetary emergency, and everything else that we're going to see happen in New York City next weekend.
Yeah, I know. I did a show on the Rockefellers some time ago, and they were talking about all like a long history of this sort of stuff, you know, and you know, they're invested in the Club of Rome and so on. So, you know, that would really make you wonder about, you know, that you know, parallel agenda there. Talking about you mentioned the kind of a renewal of Bretton Woods as well, and bringing in the financial system, and I mean, because as you know, I mean the Bretton Woods system, you know, instituted the International Monetary Fund, and essentially, you know, they got a system of essentially overruling the sovereignty of nations, you know, getting them to use structural adjustment programs, you know, regardless of who was in power, or else they would not follow up with or if they wanted to get a loan that they needed. And I know we're living in a world where just about everybody is really using a loan. I mean, is this the notion or the changes to the financial system, is this essentially about becoming an enforcer to the UN? Because I mean, I'm looking at right now the United Nations. I mean, they could say, you know, Israel has to stop their genocidal policies, and Israel can just say no. But I mean, this, you know, this financial mechanism could be a way, or one of many ways perhaps, of getting, you know, bringing power to the UN by restricting assets, funds, funding, and so forth. I mean, is that kind of what you're talking about, or is there more to it than that?
No, that's absolutely it right there. I mean, this is as you said, they keep saying it's time for a new Bretton Woods moment, et cetera. So they're trying to do the same thing we've already seen them do in the past. For those who are familiar, for example, with John Perkins' work, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, it would be that same type of strategy. And in the latest version of the Pact for the Future, they specifically mention special drawing rights, or SDR, which you may be familiar with, or maybe some of your audience. I'm not an expert on it, but I know that this has been a discussion for over a decade now. And essentially, it's not a currency. It's a they call it like a basket of financial tools or something, like, you know, they use this sort of legalese, financial economic terms. But I do know that James Corbett, of course, a great researcher on his own, since at least 2013, has been warning that the special drawing rights might be the sort of foundation for a potentially global currency. And it definitely appears that that is in the works because of this latest version of the Summit of the Future, the Pact for the Future draft, the third version, which just came out on August 27th. So it's the most recent version we have, absolutely mentions using special drawing rights as the way that nations could, get access to money. And they talk about using multilateral development banks. Well, multilateral development banks, that's the World Bank, that's the IMF. So whether it's the same old systems that we've seen them using in the past to extort resources and put their thumb over nations, or it's brand new institutions, we don't know yet, but it definitely appears to be the same old strategy at play here. But this time they're saying, because we're so late in the game and we might not accomplish the SDGs, we need all nations to step up their injection of financial cash. And of course, we're also seeing the discussion around public-private partnerships, which has been made really popular by the World Economic Forum. And so the UN latest draft says something to the effect that we need both public-private partnerships to inject money, and then we need individual nations to step up their funds that are coming in to the UN. Now, it does stop short, I will say, it does stop short of saying all nations are required to put in X amount of dollars. It's still sort of couched in kind of like softer language of we should suggest, we should recommend. And that's been one of the major complaints that people who like the UN or who think it could be a force for good have said for years, is that it has no enforcement mechanism. Now, personally, I think that's a good thing that it can't enforce these things that it would like. But there are others who would like for it to have the ability to actually enforce this. So, like I said, we'll just have to see what happens in New York City next weekend. As you mentioned, I will be there on the ground in person. I did get access for at least 2 of the days. They're doing what they're calling 2 action days, and then they're doing the actual summit. I'll be there for at least 2 of those days, and I'm going to try to get some interviews, maybe some confrontations, and just get a feel for what's going on the ground. Because one other thing I will mention is that we know that none of us have been consulted about the Summit of the Future, the Pact for the Future. The vast majority of people have no idea this is even going on, but they are absolutely going to trot out some younger folks, some indigenous folks, some women, some marginalized communities, so that they can say, we're considering all stakeholder viewpoints. And, look, we brought in the youth, we're going to listen to them. And I'm really curious to see how that plays out, because I definitely think the younger generations are being heavily indoctrinated to believe that the world is about to end. So they want to create this illusion that the youth are demanding action. The youth are demanding this pact for the future. And, if you're not taking steps, governments of the world, you're failing the younger generations. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of well-meaning, probably very intelligent young people are being manipulated and brought into this event.
Okay, well, I'm looking forward to it, Derek, and hopefully on your website you'll maybe get some interviews with some really high-profiled and influential people. Thank you so much, Derek, and best wishes.
Thank you so much, Michael. I appreciate it.
And Derek Brose is a staff writer for The Last American Vagabond, a journalist, author, documentary filmmaker, public speaker, and an activist.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States.
The Summit of the Future and its efforts to centralize control in the hands of a few is just one of many initiatives that the people of the world must wake themselves up to if they still value freedom and the idea of control being set by themselves. Now, James Corbett is an individual who, for many years now, has been raising concerns about these hazards of approaching one world government. He's going to talk to us today about some of the biosecurity and biowarfare angles that are on the horizon and other things, and about what people can do to restore our sovereignty back into our own hands. James Corbett is someone we're all familiar with by now, an award-winning investigative journalist and host and producer of CorbettReport.com, an independent, listener-supported alternative news source operating on the principle of open source intelligence and providing podcasts, interviews, articles, and videos about breaking news and important issues. James, welcome back to the Global Research News Hour.
Thank you very much for having me here, Michael, to discuss these important issues. But it seems that every few months now, we are discussing the latest threat to human liberty on the planet, and whether that's coming from the World Health Organization or from the UN directly or whatever vector it's taking, seems to all be of a certain piece and thrusting towards a certain direction. So I'm glad that we can sit here and break down what this agenda means and, more importantly, what we can do about it.
Sure. The last time we had you on the show, you were telling us about the World Health Organization's pandemic treaty, yesterday's news, but we replayed it just a few weeks ago. You had been following it for months, and there was a major popular resistance to the pandemic treaty. I mean, some people got your message. And as I understand it, there was a major demonstration put on by critics in Geneva, a Geneva convoy aimed at opposing the WHO pandemic treaty and the pandemic treaty that didn't get passed, at least not in a form that all of us recognized or expected. So at least a partial victory of sorts. But could you apprise us of what happened last May? And in your opinion, did the WHO just kick the pandemic treaty further down the road until later, or did the people successfully kick the WHO in the guts?
I suppose it is how you look at it, but I'm certainly not resting on my laurels or patting myself on the back or, oh, everything's done here. No, unfortunately, this is a war of attrition, and just because the worst didn't happen in Geneva in May does not mean that it's not an ongoing process. In fact, quite the contrary. We talk about the pandemic treaty not having passed, but really, that's only because they weren't able to finalize and get all the I's dotted and T's crossed in time for that World Health Assembly. But they've just kicked it, as you say, kicked the can down the road to or later this year, potentially. They have talked about the potential of holding a special World Health Assembly later this year to rubber stamp whatever they come up with. Or at the very, very least, next year at the next World Health Assembly, they will have a pandemic treaty ready. So unfortunately, all of that momentum and interest and enthusiasm amongst the freedom community, freedom supporting community out there, free humanity, they know how to take that energy and just divert it or cool it down or give people a sense of a victory so that they sit back on their laurels. And it is interesting, actually. You mentioned, for example, that Geneva convoy that was taking place. But from my perspective here in Japan, it's been amazing to see the pushback against the biosecurity agenda that's been taking place and really gaining momentum in Japan, especially this year. We've had a number of remarkable events I was just writing about with regards to the Replicon vaccine, which is the self-amplifying mRNA vaccine, which is sort of an upgrade or downgrade, I suppose, depending on which way you're looking at it, of the mRNA vaccine platform, which is essentially all of the worst parts of the mRNA vaccine, but even worse because it also includes a replicase protein, which will then encode for more of the mRNA within your own body that then encodes the proteins like the spike protein or whatever else Big Pharma wants to have circulating around in your system. And so if you are concerned about the mRNA vaccines and what the effects they are having on the global population, you should be very concerned about the prospect of self-amplifying mRNA vaccines and the potential, although we don't really know all of the potential effects of this, because of course it is not a thoroughly studied technology. It is a brand new experimental medical technology that has already been approved for use here in Japan and is due at this point to start rolling out in the next few weeks when the fall COVID-19 vaccination program starts here in Japan. They are supposedly getting ready to start using the self-amplifying mRNA vaccines. This is very concerning, and thankfully the Japanese people are starting to really wake up about this en masse. We saw earlier in January a vaccine study group here in Japan of some prominent doctors who held a really remarkable press conference talking about the problems of the mRNA vaccines and the many, many effects that they are having on the population. We saw a massive rally against the WHO in April, which was then parlayed into an anti-WHO group here that's about protecting the Japanese population from the global biosecurity agenda and stopping what they are calling the third atomic bomb, the self-amplifying mRNA vaccines that they say the government is now preparing to drop on its own citizens. We've seen another rally that took place in Tokyo in May, tens of thousands of people, which featured a speech from a former Japanese minister, a cabinet minister, who is still a sitting parliamentarian, who talked about his own experience developing cancer after having received the vaccine and tying those two things together, saying that, and then actually apologizing to the public, saying that these vaccines should have been tested more. They've been rolled out inappropriately. They're having a horrible effect. Actually apologized to the Japanese public for it. Startling stuff.
Did the media in Japan, are they promoting this stuff as well? Or is it?
Well, just last month, NHK, which is the Japanese national broadcaster, the equivalent of the CBC, on its a popular morning program, aired an entire segment about mRNA vaccine side effects and things that have been happening to people, vaccine adverse events, because, as they put it in their own broadcast, we've received thousands of requests from viewers out there. Thank you very much. So here's our a presentation. So they laid out an entire presentation about the mRNA vaccines, talked to people who were suffering from adverse events. Just 2 days later, the current Minister of Health in the Japanese government said, on a pretty significant walk back from the safe and effective line that we've heard from every basically health ministry in the world, said that I can't remember the exact phrasing of this, so don't quote me on this, but it was something to the effect of, we cannot guarantee the safety. As to the safety of these vaccines, we can't speak to that. Something along those lines. Anyway, it was a remarkable walk back from the position we are expected to hold. And now, next week, there is going to be an international COVID summit, which will include not only people from around the world flying in to give presentations and to interact with prominent Japanese doctors about this issue, but also they will be giving a parliamentary presentation at the Japanese parliament as part of a press conference that's happening. And there will be another massive rally in Tokyo coming up next Saturday on the 28th. So there's a lot of activity happening here, as you would expect in a country that is facing what they are calling the third atomic bomb.
Yeah, I mean, I was just wondering, because I know it sounds like the Japanese population is waking up way more than... apparently the Canadian population, I mean, notwithstanding we've had certain people speaking up, but it's pretty much quashed by the mainstream media. Let's see, I think that maybe you could talk a little bit about looking at COVID-19 retrospective as the dust settles, so to speak. Now, the next pandemic that they've been talking about, it could just be around the corner. Now, a month ago, the WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus announced an upsurge of Mpox in the Democratic Republic of Congo and a growing number of African countries who said that WHO said it constitutes a public health emergency of international concern. And... I think they the MVABN vaccine that just got added to the pre qualification list, which is necessary for timely and increased access to communities in urgent need. It's going according to an emergency listing. As with COVID-19, no evidence was supplied regarding the virus's existence. You know, it relies overly much on the RT-PCR test to detect it, which is really not good for diagnosis, as the Nobel Prize-winning inventor of RT-PCR announced. I mean, he's dead in 2019. But with this device, you can create a scare factor around the virus, making me think this could be COVID-19, the sequel, okay, Mpox. It is apparent based on much of the reporting that I've done on the show, you've done on your show regarding the pandemic, that it played a role other than healing people. It seemed to have been an attempt to test a new vaccine, not for health, but for control, and for seeing just how far you can push against democratic principles and so on. I mean, getting the entire world to lock down, all of that stuff. So I'm wondering, what role do you think this Mpox virus will play? Is this a sequel to COVID-19? Is it maybe an off thing? Because I mean, it's you know, what is similar and what is different about this latest pandemic scare, in your opinion?
Well, I think the similarities are obvious, as you point out, several of them already, and we see essentially with COVID-19, even preceding COVID-19, we see the template of how these types of pandemic scares will presumably continue to work until the public stops falling for them, which is to say PCR tests creating an appearance or a belief in a widespread phenomenon that is affecting public health. And for that reason, as we've already seen, they can lock you in your home, they can force you into quarantine, they can force you to use digital apps to scan your location, they can use contact tracing, et cetera, et cetera. The precedent has been set. Now it's just a question of finding the right trigger that will scare the public enough. And whether or not monkeypox, and I will continue to refer it to that way because I remember a year ago when that was what it was called, but I don't know if that is particularly going to be the one that will be the scamdemic sequel, but it certainly is a candidate, as is many others. In fact, I've always found it quite humorous that one thing that the WHO has been warning about is pandemic X, whatever. They literally say, well, what if we, you know, it's just some sort of hypothetical thing. It could be anything. We don't know. But in the future, where there will be some sort of pandemic X, and this X thing will have these properties and it will kill however many millions of people. And it's literally something they just made up. They're literally saying it's a hypothetical thing that we're just making up, but we should be prepared for it. So it is on its face ridiculous, but I think it shows the actual connection between so many of these different threads that we're talking about, not only the biosecurity agenda finally detailed as it may be, but also the broader agenda that's rolling out and how it connects in to that quest for world government, which I think is ultimately what all of this is really about. And we can see that, for example, from the UN Pact for the Future, the Summit for the Future that's taking place or is about to take place in New York, where they are going to be deciding on whatever they're going to be deciding on with regards to an emergency action platform that will give the Secretary General of the UN special emergency powers and whatever other authoritarian nonsense they are dreaming up, is just one part of that agenda. Another part is using the biosecurity scare to enact changes, for example, to the food supply. And if that sounds like a strange leap, well, here we go. How about in Canada right now, Bill C-293, that is Bill C-293, is currently making its way through the Canadian Senate. It is called An Act Respecting Pandemic Prevention and Preparedness, which is, of course, presumably all about how do we prevent the next pandemic, monkeypox or whatever that may be. And this has apparently been forwarded by a Liberal Party backbencher. It has already been approved in the House and is now making its way through the Senate. And apparently what this means is, given the wording, and I would suggest people go and actually read the context of Bill C-293 so they can see it for themselves. But it starts talking about regulating commercial activity to specifically prohibit any activities that may potentially give rise to some sort of pandemic in the future, including industrial animal agriculture. And it also then instructs the Minister of Agriculture to promote commercial activities that can help reduce pandemic risk, including the production of alternative proteins. And that phrase may not mean anything to people at the first level. What does that mean? Promotion of alternative proteins. Well, if you've been paying attention to the Eat the Bugs agenda, they want you to eat insects. That is going to be your new main diet staple in this new normal that they're trying to bring in on the neo-feudal plantation. You are going to be eating bugs. And part of that, they are calling it alternative proteins. It's a protein derived from, say, cricket powder and other such things that are now being approved for human consumption for the first time in the history of many. The European Medical or Food and Safety Administration has just approved, for example, cricket protein to be sold for human consumption, etc. This is called alternative proteins. And now this is being embedded in Bill C-293 in the Canadian Parliament that's talking about pandemic preparedness. So we have to start eating bugs. I mean, this is how every aspect of this global agenda starts to interlock. And to a certain extent, it almost, I won't say gives the lie to, but shows how the WHO pandemic treaty and all of that, to a certain extent, is window dressing, because this, at the end of the day, is going to be enacted in every nation state's national legislature. And it's going to be passed as, for example, Bill C-293 in Canada and whatever Senate bill or whatever in the United States, et cetera, all around the world. National legislatures are going to be forwarding suspiciously similar looking pandemic preparedness bills that will have all of this, all of these tools for control. Another thing embedded in Bill C-293 is contact tracing, of course, because the government needs to be able to have the communications technologies and facilities to be able to know everyone you're interacting with all the time, so that in case you fall ill, well, they'll be able to track everyone you've been in contact with. And that power would never be abused by any government, surely. So again, you start to see how under the cover and pretense of a sufficiently ginned up scare that gets the public worked up enough that they will give up their basic fundamental rights, the rights guaranteed under the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, right? As long as you are scared enough to be able to willingly give up those rights, the government will come along and take them gladly. And unfortunately, again, this is not just a Canadian problem. This is a global problem. It is happening in country after country all around the world. It is happening right now. And until we stop giving away our basic rights in the event of any perceived threat, and most of these threats are complete ginned up nonsense, but even if there was a real threat, that still does not give the government the right to come in and completely control my activities and start telling me to eat the bugs and all of this other self-evident nonsense.
Yeah. In case you just joined us, you're listening to the Global Research News Hour. My name's Michael Welch, and my guest is the investigative journalist and host of Corbett Report, James Corbett. James, on the subject of the Bill C-292 and other legislations that are going up in countries around the world, is there a negative in terms of people bringing forward things like, you know, something like ivermectin or anything else like that that's going to be, was pushed as an alternative to the WHO treatment? Is there some inconceivable mechanism that's going to even more profoundly marginalize those alternatives?
Yes, but the real operative question is treatment for what? Because as you say, this PCR test is something that is really not fit for purpose for diagnosing anyone with anything. It is a tool that can be used to gin up the perception of some sort of pandemic. But was there really a pandemic? And of course, researchers like Denis Rancourt there in Canada have talked about and gone in deeply into the statistics surrounding the appearance or lack thereof of an actual pandemic threat that did or did not take place in 2020, 2021. And he came to the conclusion that there was not a pandemic event that took place just based on the statistics alone. And he's done a lot of important research on that. So really the question we should be thinking about is, well, is the response, the hysterical tearing down the fabric of our society response that we saw in 2020 and 21 really proportional to what we experienced in our actual lives? And if not, then what really happened there and why is it happening? And I think that gets probably closer to the point. I mean, yes, certainly the people have talked about ivermectin and other ways of combating what these spreading pathogens, etc. And I am certainly not here to tell, I'm not a doctor, I don't play one on TV.
Neither am I.
People's personal health and the decisions they make, great, good for you. I'm sure you can do that better than I can do that for you. But having said that, I think the obvious, the 10,000 pound elephant in the room that cannot be discussed is that health is fundamentally prevention of illness. And prevention of illness involves being healthy, eating healthy, engaging in a healthy lifestyle, disentangling yourself from the glowing screen, going outside in the sunlight, grounding your feet on the actual earth, spending time in physical activity, all of these things that tend not to make money for major corporations and big pharma, etc., which is precisely why the prevention side of all of this is completely and utterly neglected. And the mantra of the mainstream establishment message over the past few years is, you got to get a needle in your arm. That is health. And once you have your needle in your arm, you know, anything. And the epitome of that particular nonsense was the giving away of free Krispy Kreme donuts. If you get your vaccination, you can get some donuts. You'll be doubly healthy. You'll have the experimental medical technology in your arm, and you'll have some donuts to clog your arteries with. It's laughable. It's ridiculous. It's utterly stupid. But I feel like I'm the one taking crazy pills, because am I the only one who sees this?
Surely. I can think of an interesting take on what you're saying, and that's with regard to what's happening in Gaza right now, where the genocide-like actions are taking place, you know, committed by Israel, and people are subjected to bombings. They're also starved of food. Water supply, half of the water supplies in the place have been destroyed. Medical supplies you can't get in, and basically the Israeli government is helpful enough to allow healthcare workers in to administer a polio vaccine once it was discovered that polio is back in the region. I mean, after all the indifference the Israeli Defense Forces have shown toward Palestinian women and children over the last 11 and a half months, I don't think that protecting them from polio really makes a lot of sense. I mean, what's behind, you know, is the vaccine, I mean, in spite of all the weapons that are being aimed at Gaza, I mean, is this vaccine an exception to that rule? I mean, is it really about saving lives, or
I think you answered your own question there, because it clearly and obviously is not about saving lives. In the midst of this, I won't even dignify it with the word war zone. It is a slaughter zone where innocent men, women, and children are being bombed to smithereens every single day. But we're going to pause that at certain times in certain places so that everyone can gather to get the shot in their arms so that they won't get polio. On its face is just ludicrous nonsense. On every level, every part of that story is stupid. But what does it signify? Why then? What is really behind this? The absolute most basic level that we can always proffer as one reason for these things to happen, clearly the corporations, the corporatocracy that puppeteers so many of our national governments, has a strong interest in, at the very least, the incredible propaganda opportunity here. Look, hey, everybody, look how important it is to get your vaccines. We will literally stop this random wanton slaughter just so that people can make sure they get their vaccines, because we love you and it's good for you. And that idea gets embedded in the public consciousness if they simply accept a story like that without questioning it. So yes, bottom line, profits, sure, that is certainly part of it. But there does seem to be a deeper agenda to this, doesn't there? Because I don't think money simply explains all of what we have seen rolling out in the past few years and what we see on the plate right now. I think this has to tie into what I keep pointing out is essentially every aspect of my work has, for the past 17 years and presumably the next 17 years, is will continue to stress. This is about a much bigger agenda that has been identified in many ways by many people over the years. It's been called the New World Order agenda, or it's been given many idea and many names, but this essential kernel of the idea is a global governmental system ruled over by a central, unelected, unaccountable body that will be issuing dictates and mandates to global citizens. And that could take many different forms. We could preserve the nation state infrastructure, but have it as a system like what we're seeing right now, where the WHO is creating this pandemic treaty that may or may not ever get passed, but every single national legislature is forwarding these various pandemic preparedness bills that essentially do all of that within those national legislatures. So that's kind of the vision of what we see rolling out before us right now. All of this is taking place within the context of an oligopoly, an oligarchy and an oligopoly that is attempting to solidify and centralize a position from which they can dictate mandates for the global population to control the world's resources, including, of course, its natural resources and also its human population. And unless and until we face that dark reality square in the face, because all my life, at any rate, that has been derided as crazy conspiracy theorizing, unless and until we can completely and utterly discard that thought-stopping pejorative of conspiracy theory and face this reality as it is coming into view, unless and until we can do that, I don't think we have a chance of turning the tide against this agenda.
Okay, I've got about 30 seconds left, but is there anything else you'd like to say to our listeners on the subjects at hand before we conclude our conversation?
Absolutely. Well, as always, the most important thing is what we can be doing about this. The number one thing right now is the number one political priority. We need to withdraw from the UN completely, totally. No questions asked, no holds barred. Withdraw from the United Nations. That is the seat from which they are trying to wield this power right now. And unless and until that becomes a political policy and a point that people are out on the streets protesting about, I don't think we have a chance against this.
Very informative viewpoints, as always, Mr. Corbett. I would like to thank you so much for once again participating in our show.
Thank you.
James Corbett is an award-winning investigative journalist and host of The Corbett Report, available at corbettreport.com. He joined us from his home in Japan.
Just a note, when we talked about treatments for COVID-19 and other pandemics earlier, it must be remembered that we are not delivering, nor are we qualified to offer medical remedies. Every individual is unique, and each person must check with his or her own physician before attempting any healthcare approach. And that is the end of this week's show. Next week is CKW's annual Pass the Mic special, featuring my special guest, David Winter Wright, the former host of the show Red Waters on radio station CJUM. He will interview Lisa Pease, a major writer and analyst of the assassination of Robert Kennedy in the 1960s, and they will discuss the recent assassination attempts on Donald Trump. Are they faked? Is there a large conspiratorial agenda here? Join us for an exciting show next week. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Ininu, Ojibwe, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show airs on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Thanks once again for joining us.